National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 9th, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security. And we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation, and sometimes across our national borders, to explore American national security issues. We cover a wide variety of topics here on National Security This Week. One week we might cover Belarus, the next we cover transnational organized crime. Today we're going to talk about the situation in Ukraine and other places too, but not in ways that you've likely heard much about in the media. We'll also venture into other crisis or potential crisis areas as part of our discussion. Our guest today will help us to understand the new modern warfare concept called hybrid warfare, which has been used, or at least tentatively tried to be used extensively by Vladimir Putin in Russia. The jury is still kind of out, I think, on how the situation in Ukraine will unfold in the end, but it's clear that hybrid warfare is now kind of front and center as a strategy. We're here now, frankly, at this point in Ukraine, with this serious crisis because of the effectiveness of hybrid warfare, or maybe not. We'll see. Depends upon what our guests have to say. And how it serves, how hybrid warfare serves as a force multiplier for traditional ways of waging war on one's declared enemies. Our first guest today is Dr. Michael Hennessy, who serves as professor of history and war studies at the Royal Military College of Canada, which is similar institution-wise to both West Point and Annapolis here in the United States. Dr. Hennessy is the past department head, past chair of war studies, past dean of the Canadian Forces Military College, and past associate vice principal of research and dean of graduate studies at the Royal Military College. Dr. Hennessy was principal author of NATO's Partner for Peace Consortium's Cybersecurity Reference Curriculum. He's also a 12-year veteran of the Canadian military's artillery and infantry. Dr. Hennessy's published works include Strategy in Vietnam, The Marines and Revolutionary War in I Corps, 1965 to 1972, and the edited work, The Operational Art, Developments in the Theories of War. Michael Hennessy was the founding editor of the Canadian Military Journal, which is the professional journal of the Canadian Armed Forces, and served as a civilian lead for the founding of the Canadian Forces Leadership Institute. Dr. Michael Hennessy has also worked on intelligence issues and questions of technology and warfare throughout his career, and he's also the proud grandson of an Irish revolutionary, and I'm going to make sure we ask him more about that story before we finish our show today. Our second guest is Professor Sean Costigan. Sean Costigan is a professor at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies and a senior advisor to the NATO Partner for Peace Consortium Emerging Security Challenges Working Group. He's a principal author of NATO's cybersecurity curriculum and the academic lead for the forthcoming NATO Partner for Peace Consortium curriculum on hybrid threats and warfare. Professor Costigan is widely published in National Security Matters relating to cybersecurity, emerging security challenges, and hybrid threats. Prior to joining the Marshall Center's faculty, Sean was the chief information officer at the MIT Press, professor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs, the director of strategic initiatives at the Center for Security Studies in Zurich, executive editor at Columbia University Press, and the research associate for science and technology at the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Costigan is a Department of Defense civilian. He's also a series co-editor for Taylor and Francis's Modern Security Studies series, and author or editor of a number of other works, including Terranomics, Cyberspaces, and Global Affairs, and another book called Arming the Future, to name but a few. Professor Sean Costigan and Mike Hennessy, Dr. Mike Hennessy, welcome to National Security This Week.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having us.
And Dr. Hennessy, where are you calling in from? I'm up on Zoom with both of you. Where are you at this morning, Dr. Okay. Hennessy?
So I'm located on the north shore of Lake Ontario in the town of Kingston, Ontario, not far from Fort Henry, which we built to protect from American invasion not that long ago.
And I suspect winter is still hard upon you up there in Canada.
Winter is trying to die.
So, okay. And Sean Costigan, where are you at this morning?
Beautiful downtown Minneapolis. Thanks, John.
All right. So you and I are going to be sharing some nice warm-up here after this weekend.
Fairly soon. Looking forward to it.
So I'm going to highlight for our listeners right up front that both of you, today you're here talking about your own personal ideas and opinions, which are your own, and that you are not serving as an official spokesperson for either the Canadian Armed Forces or the Canadian government, or for the U.S. government or DOD. Is that, that's safe to say, right?
Yes, safe to say. Thank you.
Okay. I don't want to get you in trouble with your bosses.
Thanks.
All right. So we have a lot of ground to cover today. Let me begin by asking the two of you how you connected and then partnered to start studying this issue of hybrid warfare. Can you tell us how that happened?
Mike, do you want to take a first stab at this? I was puzzling over that, John, and thinking about Mike and I have worked for roughly a decade now together on a variety of projects around the world. And when we look back at the cybersecurity reference curriculum, that's really the our first interactions. Mike, do you want to take a stab at
that? That's right. I think we first met about 2014 when I was asked to partake in the discussions about creating a reference curriculum. And Sean was on the committee that I first briefed on how to go about doing that. And we collaborated quite well on that project and had some ideas for future projects and actually agitated for quite a long time to have people pay attention to this concept of hybrid warfare. And only in the past 18 months did somebody say, hey, we'll fund some of that app, we'll fund a group to sit down and put a solid piece of work together, giving us a definitive chapter and verse.
So I was lucky enough, about a decade ago to spearhead this effort to create what we call a reference curriculum in cybersecurity, and Mike, through a mechanism of the in Canada, came to work with me. And so, from there, that luck created, I think, a rather beautiful partnership that we've been able to maintain across borders and the pandemic, and continue, to do the work that we're doing, including this new hybrid curriculum that we'll be discussing today. But the concepts around it are more important than the document. And so I think, John will be asking us a lot of questions around that, and hopefully we'll have answers.
Oh, we've got plenty of questions for you today. Don't worry. So your respective careers and backgrounds, what was it about your individual backgrounds that kind of drove you to look at this topic of hybrid warfare? What was it about it that kind of interested you enough that you wanted to sit down, partner up, and study it? Maybe we'll start with you, Sean, this time.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thanks, John. No, the way I think of the work that I do very often is sort of a sentinel foresight effort, where I look around and say, I was trained in the history of science, worked in science and technology policy. And so very often I'll follow a rabbit trail down where technological change has given us some indication that there's some societal change or national security impacts. And from that leads me into a variety of different roles that give me thought as to what we might need or where we might have some improvements. And so it was really from that initial impulse, like a lot of the work that I do, where I start thinking about what's changed in technology, what are the national security impacts, does that have some impact for our militaries or for broadly our partners and allies. And from there, hybrid came top of mind, of course. So there, that's my rationale.
Okay. And Mike?
Yeah, I've always been intrigued and worked on issues like guerrilla warfare, counter-guerrilla warfare, terrorism, counter-terrorism, asymmetric warfare. And, the experience is you got a lot of kind of buzzwords percolating all the time through the system. Yeah. And some of them are worth catching on to and trying to refine and understand their meaning. And others are problematic and cause confusion and sow discord and so on. So I kind of chase these ideas now and then because it's certainly, teaching my students, they're interested in these kind of emerging concepts. But as a historian, you also see a wider context of, there's always been promises of change. There's always been, what new revolutionary thing is going to transform warfare fundamentally. And you often poke these ideas and realize, there's some real changes, yes, but complete transformation of warfare and all the old historical record gets tossed out. Usually not. So it's that kind of that testing function that attracts you to exploring these ideas. And that's why I dipped into cyber. And that's why we picked up on hybrid warfare.
Yeah. I'd add there, too, it's sort of the wicked problems that interest us both that are, these definitional challenges. So where there's a lack of definition, just as there is internationally for cyber, there's this space where confusion might reign, or where a variety of efforts to create clarity might also be possible. And it's those efforts at clarity that Mike and I have spent a great deal of time working through.
And Mike, or Sean, I should say, let me follow up on something you just said. You used the term wicked problem. I found, yeah, unfortunately, that not everybody understands the definition of what a wicked problem is. I think those, yeah, of us in the national security world are pretty familiar with that term. But can you sort of explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, or do you have a ready one? I'm eager, because that in and of itself is a wicked problem. I mean, I've seen so many definitions of them, but it's, you know, it's where there's sufficient complexity that it makes definitional problems real, and makes inaction a possibility as well, because people don't know exactly what to do. So any of these wicked problems might be best explained by some example. So national security and climate change,
yeah,
a wicked problem. Right. Others, but I don't, John, if you have I'm all ears if you have one that's a great definition.
I don't have a great definition. I've always sort of understood it as a problem that's so complex that it's hard to really get your head around it, because it's so complex. And then there's rarely a good solution. You know, there's not a perfect solution. You're just going to have choices of what's the least bad solution you can apply.
That's right. That's the way I perceive it too. And the other aspect of it is typically wicked problems, at least from the NatSec perspective, or involve whole of government responses. And so that's where it's also adds complexity, because you have to who does what and when makes it interesting from my perspective. So I've also worked on years ago on national security and climate change, and so that was my first real introduction, I'd say, to the big issues of wicked problems.
And Professor Kosygin, let me follow up. Your expertise is also in cyber operation and cyber operations and emerging challenges. Maybe you could comment just very briefly, because I'm sure we're going to talk about this a lot more today, on the importance of understanding cyber threats in a modern national security environment.
Yeah, I know we're going to be talking quite a bit about Ukraine later on, but I think one thing that I want to drive home as quickly as possible is that there are things that we can do about cybersecurity. And let me just give some practical examples, because it may help people as they think about, you know, if you're a small enterprise and you think, oh goodness, you know, here comes a problem in Ukraine, or here comes something that may affect my effort, or you're a larger enterprise or an individual. I think there are practical things that can be done in cyber, and cyber has matured enough, in my estimation at least, that it's no longer what I would consider to be an emerging field. But I'll footnote that, and we can talk about that later, because there's a distribution problem at the same time, which is that it's emerging differently in different places. And so that is still the case internationally. But some practical things that may be useful to people that Mike and I detail in the cybersecurity reference curriculum and in other works that we've done is, you know, a few very basic stuff. There's a technological layer that includes just patching and making sure that you don't keep your doors open to, a perpetrator of a crime or a nation state or whomever else. This is basic stuff, gets overlooked all the time. And so I just want to, you know, reiterate that. But then one thing that I've been talking about quite a bit since Ukraine kicked off is that just practicing your plans for emergencies, whatever those are. And, John, I'm sure you're very familiar with these things and you're nodding your head. And I know, Mike, we think about the same things, but it's basic stuff like this that gets overlooked until there's a disaster, until there's a problem. And so practice for emergencies, whatever those are, your remediation plans, know who to call, all this sort of basic stuff that keeps you out of 90% of the problem is what I'd want to talk about in cyber to begin with. Yeah. So, Mike, I want to bounce it over to you. I know you have other thoughts on cyber, but I'd like to start with the practical, John, because otherwise it becomes, you know, a very theoretical discussion for a lot of people, and people don't know what to do. So,
right.
Yeah. So just a little broader context to the cyber realm is, you know, the fact it's such a straddling problem. It's individuals have to deal with this problem. Companies have to deal with the problem. Governments have to deal with the problem. International organizations have this problem. And, you know, we've observed the kind of development of a lot of coordinating tissue across those parties. Part of that being forced by discussion of people saying, hey, you have to look at this problem. It's not going to solve itself. Individuals look for guidance. They want authoritative guidance. They know there are companies selling solutions, but is it a problem? The development of things like cyber insurance, you know, a really developing field. How do you measure this risk? What is the risk? When does it go? When does bank fraud become a cyber problem as opposed to just a problem of fraud?
Yeah.
And so you've got all these straddling issues, and this is kind of that wickedness of the problem. Who's responsible for putting it all together?
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's not a military problem. It's not a Defense Department problem. It's not a State Department problem. You know, it's what segment of the government is actually responsible for going, you know, comprehensively, this whole threat surface needs to be addressed. A bunch of people have to sit down and agree who's going to do what.
Yep. Yeah, that's always a challenge.
It's an everybody problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an everybody problem. But I think, you know, one of the interesting things there that I'd add too is that I think computing technology in general is sneaky technology, and we didn't recognize the sets of risks that Mike discusses, you know, that how they cross boundaries until relatively late. And that, I think, is tied to notions of progress, where we're very keen to adopt new things, and we certainly don't want to be seen as not being, you know, sufficiently progressive. So we're looking around saying, by all means, install new software, install new devices, install and make sure I'm on the cutting edge, only to find later that X, Y, or Z risks have been run and threats are real. And so this is where we are. And then the question of ownership, precisely what Mike says, is the thing that we're dealing with. And that also, you know, feeds into hybrid in some way. So it's that sneaky,
and you have
sneaky
things
side
like,
of things.
You know, security was an afterthought for the internet.
Oh, totally. Yeah. No question.
So,
I've got
the illusion of security and the realities of it. And they're two different things. And now people are recognizing you need to design security at the start, not after the fact.
Yeah. I have a friend of mine who actually was on the show a year ago, who's a computer science professor here at Carleton College, and he has said that same thing over and over again, that they totally did not even consider the issue of security when they were creating the internet, and there's really nothing about it that's designed to be secure. You'd almost need to go back to the drawing board, redevelop it all over again with security being the primary driver, and then roll out an entirely new internet.
And we can imagine what appetite there is for that.
None.
You know, given the difficulties Mike and I just had coming up with an internationally acceptable solution for a definition for cybersecurity.
Yeah.
But nonetheless.
Which we agreed there wasn't one, so we made one up.
And, that was it. Out of exhaustion, we just agreed.
So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, and we're broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Professor Sean Costigan and Dr. Mike Hennessy, and we're talking about the concept of hybrid warfare and how it might be used in today's conflicts. So, gentlemen, let's go ahead and dive into our topic for today. We're going to hit this in multiple layers, but we're going to talk hybrid warfare. I think it might be best, frankly, for our audience, if we start by outlining what sort of traditional, conventional forms of warfare entail, just to remind everybody what the old way of doing business was, maybe we start there. And Mike Hennessy, why don't we start with you? What do you think are a good way to frame up the traditional tenets of conventional warfare? How has warfare always traditionally been executed?
Well, let me just say, I think in the popular imagination, we can all kind of get that Omaha Beach model of what a large combat operation looks like, gathering of mass forces, overwhelming firepower, attacking a fixed geographic point, you know, punching through enemy lines with both the will of the infantry and firepower of artillery and naval guns, penetrating inland, having a big logistical tail to support that, and winning a pretty kind of conventional battle. And we're certainly seeing some of those kind of battles going on in the Ukraine. But there's a lot of other activity as well.
Any thoughts from your side, Sean, as you've been looking at this issue too over the course of your career?
Yeah. I think as we talk a little bit more about, you know, what makes it different in hybrid, I'll have more to add. But I think I agree. You know, Mike has, you know, more than adequately described, you know, what I think is in the popular imagination. And we see some of that as well in the imagery that comes out of war, you know, today, even hybrid war, if we want to describe Ukraine as that, it clearly has moved into what, from my perspective, is traditional warfare at the same time. And so we see images of traditional warfare, of refugees, of, you know, trees without their tops, of buildings that have been bombed, of bodies, all the things that remind us of what war really is at the end of the day. But I'll stop there and go back to you, John, because I know we want to dive into what makes hybrid.
Yeah, and I'll just add, and maybe Mike, you can comment on this a little bit too. When we do planning for combat operations, We have a whole series of things that we go through to plan how we're going to carry out an attack on the enemy or even a defensive fight as the enemy is coming at us, phase lines, branches and sequels, branch plans in case something goes wrong, or sequel in case you do break through, catastrophic success, as we say, and you look for new opportunities to exploit weaknesses in the enemy's front. Yeah. So those are the kind of things that, I mean, anything you want to say about that, Mike? You were an infantry and artillery guy. You know a lot more about ground combat than I ever will.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of battle where you break, you know, a breakthrough meeting engagement where you fight a conventional force, defeat it, and then break behind them and outmaneuver them and win the field, right? They're either driven from the battlefield, they withdraw, or you annihilate them. You know, somebody's principles of war includes annihilation.
Yeah.
Right? But that kind of 3-to-1 overmatch ratio that people use as a planning tool, that these kind of rough bromides of the calculus. But those are all kind of conventional war fighting tools, but there's a much bigger battle space, of course.
Right. And a lot of people I've said this before on the show, you know, amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. The Russians might have been well served to think a little bit more about their own logistics tail for the Ukraine operation. But most people don't realize it's like a 10-to-1 tail to tooth ratio in most combat operations. Only one out of every 10 soldiers or Marines or whatever is up there in the front fighting the enemy. The rest of it is all support mechanisms, making sure that they get the ammunition and the medical supplies and the food and the water and whatnot, the fuel that they need to carry out those operations in a conventional fight.
Yeah.
So now I think we have sort of a reference in our heads about what traditional warfare sort of looks like and how it's executed. Let's talk a little bit about how hybrid warfare is different. Which of you would like to kind of kick off and talk to us a little bit about why it's different, this hybrid warfare approach?
I might start with that, Mike, unless you want to jump in. So, you know, the short list, I think, first of all, we already alluded to some of this when we started off, is this lack of a definition, right? It's that lack of a definition that allows for activity in the space that makes things interesting intellectually, but also makes things quite difficult to combat and on the countering side of it. And tied to that is this deniability is increased. So in this sort of overall cloud of confusion, not only about the definition, but about, you know, as it's happening, as with cyber as well, a successful hybrid operation may not be observed by a target, right, until it's complete. And that includes those who are internationally observing it. So we've all heard about like little green men and, you know, these concepts, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But there's this intentional muddying, which makes things very difficult for people who are otherwise astute observers to be able to look at this space and say, aha, this is evidence of conflict. This is evidence of, right, an act of war. This is evidence of use of force. And so that space is, I think, the key. These are key definitional points. And then I'd say, so it counts on this blurring of different concepts of warfare as well, and different concepts of information operations, et cetera, to allow it. And that's the central challenge. So from my perspective.
Yeah, just to further that, you know, there is disagreement over the use of the term, say, hybrid warfare, to talk about activity short of something like formal war, and hybrid warfare as part of a conventional war. And I think we're seeing that line really blurred right now, where you've got in the Ukraine both activities going on at the same time. It's not, you've moved from one to another. And that kind of debate was there in the literature well before this, and it's kind of remains unresolved. And I think that's why some countries don't use the term hybrid warfare. They use hybrid threats. Some countries like the term hybrid war, as opposed to hybrid warfare. It's quite interesting how that divvies up. But irregular warfare, to me, it really is forms of struggle where a state is very willfully, you know, trying to attack the will of another party using a whole series of means that are short of armed hostility. There might be violence. There might be intimidation. There might be all sorts of activities we've seen for centuries of corruption, elite capture, information operations going from, you know, the yellow journalism of the 19th century to kind of cyber communications and so on. But there has to be a sense of a design, of a hand behind it, doing it on purpose, with a willful intent to either undermine the will of an opponent or gain their way short of war, and maybe set the conditions for a successful war.
Yeah, this goes all the way back. I mean, we end up talking about Sun Tzu, we end up talking about Clausewitz, so all the touchstones, you know, that you're familiar with, John, and that many of the listeners, I'm sure, you know, have on their bookshelves now, or maybe in front of them. These are still here. There's both something is new and nothing is new problem all together in hybrid. And so, you know, Mike, I think, has done a best job that I've seen thus far of anybody describing what it is that we're talking about. So
it sounds to me, it's kind of like, you know, when we used to talk about denial and deception operations. Is this sort of denial and deception operations done using modern technological capabilities in some regards, flooding the infosphere with misinformation or disinformation, or, you know, maybe it's truth, but it catches your attention in one area while you're accomplishing something in another area. And it's either done prior to hostilities or in conjunction with a hostile action, a full-blown offensive. Do I sort of have that right? Am I close?
I think there's something to that. I think there's a piece of this, which is the technological opportunity that is available. So there's the technology renewing interest in what otherwise would have been maybe more tried and true concepts described differently than hybrid. And then as well, technology giving, I'd say, cover essentially at the end of the day for other opportunities as well. So it's both. We've become interested in it, I think, because of some of the things that have happened, the shifts that have happened in the technological space. So then that includes some of the terms that you know, describe, and the concepts you described, John. So misinformation, disinformation, information operations being a big, big chunk of this, but not the only.
Yeah. So the technology is a big enabler, and it's been, you know, harnessed on purpose with malintent. And getting people to agree that there's actually malintent and design behind it is problematic, because people don't want to see certain things for a whole bunch of reasons. But, you know, if you look at say, what Russia has shut off in the past couple of weeks and what China regularly bans, why do they shut down those lines of communications? Because they see the value of those tools and the power of those tools. But, you know, they're open to our people to use them all the time.
So it seems to me, as I'm looking at this, and the two of you are going to be the experts on this, but that hybrid warfare has really been applied to some extent anyway with Putin's advance, not just into Ukraine over the last two weeks, but his assaults into Georgia in 2008, his cyber attack on Estonia even before then, his annexation of the Crimea, the little green men problem that you just mentioned, Sean, and even his investment of Donetsk and Luhansk. Before he just recently recognized them and officially seized them with military force. Has Putin been carrying out hybrid warfare for well over a decade now? Is that what's really been going on?
So, you know, what's in a name? So the Russians say they don't do hybrid warfare. It's a Western term. And they accuse the West of using hybrid warfare and responsible for all those color revolutions, making their lives uncomfortable.
By saying that, you know, the internet is a weapon of the CIA, to quote Putin, you know, for example. So these are thoughts along that line.
Yeah. So there's clearly been some design to what Russia's been doing. How they exactly class it, I think, is debatable. You know, we had the term the Gerasimov Doctrine came out a few years ago. The writer who actually wrote that said, actually, I didn't mean that. I just made that up because it's a catchy title. but it seems to explain what the Russians are doing by capturing observed behavior, right? We don't have a nice touchstone of exactly how Russia sees this all being pulled together. At least I haven't seen one.
Okay. Anything to add to that, Sean?
No, I agree. I mean, there's a bit of a quantum problem, a measurement problem here, where you know we see it. We see it in action, and we attempt to measure it, but I don't think there's an adequate theory of hybrid at this point.
Okay. I'm going to have more questions on that. I got to do a quick break here. For our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Professor Sean Costigan and Dr. Mike Hennessy, and we're talking about the concept of hybrid warfare and how it might be used in today's conflicts. Let's drill down a little bit more into the hybrid warfare thing. Can you, so you've been studying this, both of you, for a while now. Can you outline a sequence of events for how hybrid warfare might be executed? We can use either the events of Ukraine or if you wish, or we can use this as a theoretical approach for how hybrid warfare works. Either way, I think is fine. It'll still deliver to our listeners so the conceptually what we're talking about here. And I'm sure I'm going to have some follow-up questions as we go through this this question. So I don't know if one of you wants to get start us off.
Mike, you want to jump on it? We've conceived of a way to describe it. That's a portion of the cybersecurity, rather the hybrid curriculum that we're working on right now. But definitely a work in progress.
Sure.
But nonetheless, I think we have a few steps. Not that we're suggesting you should follow these steps if you want to engage in hybrid warfare yourself. That's a different business. But just conceptually to describe it, Mike, do you want to start or?
Yeah. So. I think the Russian intervention in 2014 in the Ukraine, yeah. Those little green men gave us some indication of the transition from just politically undermining a situation to exploiting it through force, mm-hmm. which was the big wake-up call, I think, for NATO, that you not just only had a lot of political argument and political factions coming to the fore, but they were wedded with things like, a motorcycle gang in Russian colors racing forward to capture key road junctures. People appearing not to be in Russian uniforms, but in Russian uniforms without insignia, mysteriously overnight and claiming kind of no nationality. Mm-hmm. So that kind of continuity from low-level political agitation and destabilization to armed intervention through both proxy forces and conventional forces, it kind of shows that kind of spectrum of behavior that everybody fears. But I think more broadly, you have to think about hybrid warfare as, we can think of kind of tactical targets where you might get that set up. But the activity of creating social fissures or harnessing social fissures or deepening social fissures, undermining the will for a cohesive response, for people to have a clear picture that they're actually under threat, because there are multiple voices saying, well, there's no real threat. It's just mm-hmm. investment. They're just buying some land. They're just, it's
they're
a
just
good company
advertising
that we're dealing with.
Right.
The advertising, they want to be our friends. It's life is normal and we should just carry on and not be afraid.
Yes.
So those are all part and parcel of some of these behaviors. And so the undermining is not just at the immediate local audience, but quite broadly. So,
that's right.
The efforts to destabilize public support for NATO intervention is taking place not just in Ukraine and in Poland, but in France, in the United States, in Canada, around the world.
Yeah. And
this morning about the Spanish media is getting lots of feed out of Latin America that is full of the Russian story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And absent, cohesive description of hybrid. We point to examples, and again, I'm going to point to Russia as a very fine student of the fissures in our society. So we've seen this, and I imagine on your show too, John, you've explored this, multiple times. But when an outfit like the Troll Farm in St. Petersburg spends a lot of time trying to figure out where are the fissures, and they have maps and they've got demographic data, and they look at it and say, what is it that we can use, and how can we undermine even a response to allow ourselves the space to operate. And they might not understand the overall picture of how the intention might be to make it so difficult for another state to even have a cohesive response internally that it may be difficult for them to respond externally to a threat or support a partner or an ally when it comes about. And so part of this sort of like giant cloud of confusion is intentional to create the space to operate and to undermine the international order as we have it. And so that's my perspective on it. And that includes information operations at a level that may look very innocuous and may look very benign, but taken in their totality are quite effective at undermining our will to be able to make a response. And another example that I'd give there, and again, we're going to point to Russia, but is the inclusion of the television station RT in many of the networks, and then its subsequent removal later on after the Ukraine crisis. But to look at RT. It is complicated because RT obviously could have the possibility of having been a good station, but at the same time, I think is widely recognized by U.S. Officials as having been essentially a propaganda tool. It's the same for Europe in general, and so European stations have pulled them off the air.
Yeah.
Right? They're not there anymore, and there's a reason for that, and that's after a decade plus of polluting and effectively creating controversy and creating divisions that make it difficult for states to be able to respond. So.
Yeah, Sean, I think you nailed it. I've been kind of watching that over the past decade with RT and their alignment with whatever the Kremlin latest statements are was really amazing, and their ability to sort of get inside our societies in the West to undermine confidence in our government and sow distrust between us as citizens. Talking about the work of the troll farm sounds to me like the internet is a pretty important tool when it comes to this idea of how you execute hybrid warfare. I might even suggest that part of this is, to some extent, a covert action, as we traditionally understand covert action, influence operations, using the power of the infosphere through the web. Am I close on this, Mike Hennessy? Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, it's a tool that can be used for subversion. It's a transmission belt for dissonant voices. And, you know, if you think about war and clarity, it adds to the fog. And fog causes hesitation and lack of clarity and lack of response. And your opponent, if they've done that, has succeeded.
So we use this term in the military. Oh, go ahead, Sean. Sorry.
No, sorry, John. Yeah, you see that. Also, this is an example of measuring by response. So if Russia looks at it or China or others looks at the open internet as a threat, right? They also look at it as an opportunity. The threat aspect of it is evident when they do things like create a sovereign internet. So that's because of the fear that they understand that they've encoded as in their own actions, in my estimation, through the exploitation of various information channels to undermine the enemy. They look around and say, they want to make sure there's no jujitsu here, that this doesn't come back and get them. Yeah. So they're going to do these things. And we're seeing it in real time now, the notion that we're going to cut off services to make sure that you're not going to be, you won't have access to our populations. And to, but you also see a lot of this is fear-based, John, and I think we'll probably describe, some of that a bit more. But if you look at how quickly Russia acted in Kazakhstan, I believe that's largely fear-based.
Yeah.
That they looked around and said, we have to do something as quickly as possible to quell dissent, because you're only, 2 or 3 days away from losing power in one of these color revolutions that he's so fearful of. And so that's the wide picture on this that I think really comes back down to the influence operations, as you say, the covert operations and the other possibilities that are here that they use against us. With great aplomb.
Yeah. So if we know that the internet is so vital, I think a lot, and the two of you probably were watching this same as I was, the anticipation was that when the Russians launched their offensive into Ukraine, that the Ukrainians would lose their internet, that the Russians would take down the internet. And that has not happened. Any thoughts on that? I mean, why? I mean, if the Russians have this idea of the importance of flooding the infosphere with information and then maybe cutting off the ability for your opponent to communicate, why didn't they do more to try and take down the Ukrainian internet?
There's so many questions about the whole conduct of the invasion. It's such a strange type of operation that they've launched with, given the size of the country, relatively small numbers against an almost equally matched, the Russian formal armies, like 270,000 troops.
Yeah.
270,000 troops. So is it a capacity? Is it a vision? Is there redundancy that the Ukrainians built over since 2014? They learned a lot from the experience in 2014.
Yep.
And they learned about across the Georgian experience too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So perhaps they built redundant systems hard to shut down, but, reading stories about Russians using captured cell phones so they can communicate because their secure communications are not secure.
Yeah. I think the really interesting thing here from my perspective too is they basically seeded the space, in my estimation, to TikTokers and to others who are able to much more effectively maneuver in social media space. And so, you know, there's this image that we've presented of the Russians, you know, over time being, you know, exceedingly capable, the greatest students of, you know, the divisions that we have and all the, you know, weaknesses that we have, and they're going to continue to exploit them. And then, as you say, it seems to all fall flat, strangely, and either maybe that was because of the surprises that happen in conflict, where you look at it and say, you maybe they expected it to go very quickly and they didn't even think they needed to do X, Y, and Z. But by the time you end up where we are now, which is the youth of Ukraine giving a TikTok tutorial on how to start a Russian tank that's been mired in the mud, or Benny Hill set to, Benny Hill's theme song, set to a Ukrainian farmer moving a tank, with a tractor, you end up with, this proposition, which is, how is it, in fact, that the Russians supposedly, you know, who are at the vanguard of all of these things, basically ceded this territory and have lost, in my estimation, the information operations space almost completely for now. So I don't think there's an easy answer. But it's
at least in the West, right? Yeah, at least in the West, in the English press.
But kudos to the Ukrainians, right? Kudos to the Ukrainians for having the nous and the capability to be able to maintain this space, because otherwise, who knows what would be happening right now?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating if you take a look at some of the news coverage that's come out of Ukraine, the fact that just ordinary Ukrainian citizens have gotten together in basements where they still have internet connectivity, and they are running the tables on the Russians on countering the disinformation operations and really undermining Russian morale in many regards by getting us so much truthful information out across the web. I'll add a couple other concepts for you that I'd like you guys to address. We know that Elon Musk jumped in on this and wanted to get Starlink terminals seeded all over Ukraine to make sure that they had continuous coverage. And we also know that when things started, the assumption was that the Russians were going to go in and start hacking into Ukrainian systems and whatnot. And Microsoft got engaged in this whole effort to try and make sure that things stayed secure. As part of this whole challenge with the hybrid warfare area, that it's really even private companies that become engaged in actual conflict operations. Is that what the new world is teaching us about being connected to the web?
Well, I mean, on the cyber side, I'll just take that briefly. I mean, Microsoft has had an advanced effort over the years, having learned the hard way, right? Having been, Microsoft being instrumental to so much of the modern infrastructure that we all deal with globally, that they've learned the hard way that they, in fact, are on the vanguard. They're, in fact, are the sentinels for so much, and they're the solution in their own way. So there's a statecraft element to it, but there's also just a very practical reality, which is that we described early on in the program, which is, who's going to do anything about this?
Yeah.
If not you, if you're not going to defend your own space, and obviously Microsoft doesn't have armed forces here, but they're very, very clear to be thinking about where they need to be securing the network broadly, mm-hmm. because again, an impact like SolarWinds, know, would have impact across the entire internet. So recklessness somewhere in the system, and the Russians have shown themselves to be very reckless in many ways in cyberspace, will have impact across many of the other platforms. And so, for all of us, all the way down to the individual user. So I'd start there. And it's a recognition of practicality, I think, that leads Microsoft and Google and others to really have but there is this bleeding of lines where, who has responsibility for national security interests? Well, it's the state at the end of the day, in my estimation, and not corporations, but corporations have a vanguard sentinel role in addition to a practical role for themselves and their and for their constituents or their customers in this instance. So
this is kind of a new and interesting space, right? The size of some of our corporations, Apple cutting off Apple Pay in Russia, for instance. Strategic effect, not really, but interesting that a company has taken that position in a war that actually doesn't involve them.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So we've got these new transnational corporations that are what? Acting as referees and arbiters.
Yeah. Although isn't that also, in effect, that didn't they have to, if there were going to be a variety of banking measures, et cetera, they have to, it may look good as well in some instances.
Sure.
So, you don't want to be on the wrong side of history, as it were.
So it sounds to me, based on what we've been talking about so far this morning, we got about 15 minutes left on the show, that this hybrid warfare is really it's the exercise of statecraft using all forms of modern national power in doing things, you know, really out of the box, cyber operations, media manipulation, those kinds of things. So we've seen that sort of the practical application or abject failure, to however you want to look at it, in the Russian invasion of Ukraine in some of these areas. Maybe we should swing over to the Indo-Pacific theater and think about this from the context of China trying to seize Taiwan kind of an operation. China is a significantly more powerful country than Russia. They've been really doing a lot of research, development, testing, and evaluation on some really high-end technology capabilities. I think they have a much more cohesive approach to how they view their national security apparatus. What might that look like from a hybrid warfare concept or a hybrid operations concept if China were to initiate an operation to seize Taiwan? What might we see coming as the early stages and then once things really kick off? What do you think?
So I hope to be in Taiwan in the fall. I was supposed to be there last fall, so hopefully it's still free Taiwan in the fall. You know, we spent a lot of time looking at the kind of maritime dimension of kind of hybrid warfare that China seems to engage in, using a series of forces that are not military forces, just its fishing fleet, you know, anchoring off the coast of the Philippines and not budging from disputed waters, laying claim to territory and then installing military installations, despite some international rulings and despite a clear contest of the claim. Using its Coast Guard in innovative ways to intimidate others. You know, they built a very large Coast Guard ship last year with a very strengthened bow. So it's a large ship with a strong bow. So it can kind of bump other ships, because in maritime law, big ships are given way by little ships. Mm-hmm. And they've got the means now to kind of push you out of the way. So, you know, they've got a ship with big shoulders. They did that on purpose.
Yep.
To contest something. So that's going on all the time in the across the Pacific, and particularly around the Taiwan, but down in the South China Sea as well, right? Against Vietnam, against the Philippines, against a bunch of small states that have different claims. But I just, you know, we haven't talked about, you know, there were riots 2 weeks ago in Nepal.
Yeah.
And you think, what's going on in Nepal? Why are there riots? Because America is giving several hundred million dollars of aid to build an infrastructure. What's behind the riots? I'd argue there that there's Chinese influence in that society, which is not necessarily anti-American in a grand scheme of things, but very specifically anti-American in Nepal because it's seen as China's neighbor.
Influenced by China and Myanmar right now, too, in support of the military junta. Sean, what are your thoughts? I mean, if China were to initiate something against Taiwan, what should we be looking for?
Well, you know, coming to mind, you know, that several ideas, but I wanted to talk about Hong Kong for a moment, because
sure.
I think there are some lessons there
about
the response to essentially, you could call it a hybrid takeover, the use of various forces that short of the use of force or armed combat, you see how the population of Hong Kong responded with varieties of protests and that looked like they were productive in some way, but actually information technology, again, in my estimation, plays an incredible role. And the Chinese, again, have been very good students at doing things like facial recognition, at doing things like arresting leadership, at doing things like, despite all of the efforts that the protesters, in my estimation, came up with, and very clever efforts like using umbrellas to make sure drones weren't, you know, watching them overhead, et cetera, et cetera. We see all these things playing out. But the frightening prospect is that that China has very good control and very good ideas about how to control populations through information technology. And that, I think, played out in Hong Kong. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if, through aggression from the Chinese on Taiwan, we'd see the same, playing out there. So I'd want to start there. The other piece that I talk about is this may be near and dear to you, John, but is GPS spoofing has been very interesting, you know, as a concept too. This idea that you could mess around with civilian civilian signals, right? Ultimately, military signals, but they have been made in civilian hands that we're all dependent on, and alter ever so slightly the space to create disasters, which would allow for other things to happen. So you could imagine a variety of provocations that could occur through created accidents, in my estimation. So, you know, that's all well short of talking about what would happen in Taiwan. And I know, you know, John, you know a lot more about Taiwan than I do. So perhaps you want to give us your ideas here, and we can banter back and forth on. Mike knows about it much better than I do, so I'll stop there.
Well, what I would say, just you know, I think all three of us know this, and probably a lot of our listeners have been tuned into this too. The Chinese have been doing a tremendous job gathering data from all around the world. Yeah. They are really trying to operationalize the concept of big data and how that can be used to their advantage. Certainly, there's an inextricable economic link between Taiwan and mainland China. I wouldn't imagine that the mainland Chinese, the Beijing government, would want to lose that crown jewel of economic opportunity that Taiwan is. But certainly they don't. I mean, it's been stated for many, many decades that they want to unify all of China. So it's just a question of, I think most people are thinking when, not if, at this point.
There's an industrial edge there too that I'd want to just put an earmark, you know, an earworm for us all to think about, which is that, you know, in the pandemic, we saw how important semiconductors were and shortages. And Taiwan clearly has an advantage, not just in capacity, but in technological innovation that China just doesn't have. Acquiring that through aggression wouldn't be, you know, out of my mind for thinking that. I think there are others who have thought the same.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think they're also quite content for a while to use the, you know, there's a lot of internal dissent within Taiwan. There's always a block. The population would be happy to unify tomorrow. But, you know, they could win this at the polls. It's one of those long-term things. The turn that's gone on in China being more draconian has dampened that ardor within Taiwan. But, you know, silver tongues for a couple generations might do it. The deep emotional attachment in China is so visceral and real. It's not just party. I was at a conference. Two Chinese colonels stood up. Imagine two American colonels saying this, stood up in public forum and said, if our government ever ceded its claim to Taiwan, we would overthrow the government. We're talking about their government.
Wow. Yeah, I would tell you, Mike, and maybe you and I have seen some of the same things. Maybe a decade or 15 years ago, even certainly about a decade ago, there were a lot of young people in Taiwan who really wanted to connect with their Chinese heritage, their roots on the mainland. Sure. And like you said, over time, they might have succeeded in doing this. But Xi Jinping has really, I think, turned people off to that with actions in the Western provinces and certainly in Hong Kong and some of the other things that they're doing in the First Island Chain. So I think both of you probably know Professor Raymond Kuo. I had him on here. We had a lengthy conversation about Chinese activity in the South China Sea. We certainly talked a little bit about Taiwan as well. We did not get into the concept of hybrid warfare with regard to China, though. So let me ask you the million-dollar question in the few minutes that we have left. You've both studied this concept of hybrid warfare. How do you deter hybrid warfare, and if necessary, how do you defeat it? Let's finish on a strong note. I'm hearing silence. So this is terrifying.
Yeah, I think a valuable concept that Sean and I have kicked about is, it's out of cyber, actually. They use the term advanced persistent threat, that cybersecurity has to be conceived around this concept of advanced persistent threats. And I think if you recognize that maybe we have a class of world systems and great powers interaction where there's an advanced persistent threat from several very large powers whose way of life is inimical to ours, and they are willfully trying to undercut us. And so that's across the board. And so the response has to be coordinated across the board. And part of it is imagined as actually a threat.
I think there's absolutely, and I think that stripping deniability is a key here. And the United States, I think, was very, and European allies as well, was very good at doing that with Russia very early on, although there was some doubt, obviously, about the intelligence reports, et cetera, but if you think about what the Biden administration did and the intelligence community in the United States did in terms of exposing what we knew, not necessarily methods, right? There are no methods were exposed,
right.
But rather what we knew to be probable, That was really key, I think, for and that's, I think, the number one move that you can make in this space is strip deniability and make sure people know what's likely to happen. And if you do that, then you can imagine measures and countermeasures and all the different things that you can do to respond. So that's your first step. Take away the cover.
Would you say that the diplomatic engagement on the part of the allies and the liberal democracies around the world ahead of this, what we knew was going to be an invasion, really made a big difference in solidifying the response and stripping away the falsehoods?
Yeah, I think it can't be done without the, you know, I'm jaded and biased on this, but I think it can't be done without the partners and allies aspect. You know, we need people to work together and understand what these threats are and what their threats may be to themselves ultimately, because this isn't just an over there problem like so many of these problems. This is a problem that affects us very directly. It might affect you in Ottawa, it might affect us in the United States. There are impacts that are being played out for all of us. And so to the extent that we can get clarity, that's where I'd start. Through,
yeah, you know, FDR used the phrase to make the world safe for democracy. And it meant more than just being a democracy. It meant being an active democracy, that it's a precious thing. It can be destroyed. There are forces that do not like democratic states.
Yeah.
And democratic states have to recognize that they act in concert to preserve democracy, or they are just passive targets.
So we
are- and I think too on that, sorry John, there are, you know, partners internally, domestically, depending on, you know, where you are, that also have poorly understood the order that has enabled them to get good, essentially. And that's in the post-World War II order that helped us all get to a position, I think, of strength. And that includes Russia and China to some extent as well. And yet they perhaps resent or want to alter that order for their own opportunity. And that might be, you know, that's quite frightening in some regards. So
yeah, well, I think we've definitely we've known for probably a decade now that the post-World War II international security framework has been challenged by certain countries around the world. But I think with the invasion of Ukraine, it is sort of an open conflict now between the autocracies and the democracies over what the world order is going to look like going forward. So we have a huge fight ahead of us. We have time for one last question. I promised our audience I'd ask this one. Dr. Hennessy, grandson of an Irish revolutionary, what's the story there?
Well, I'll keep it short. You have played a small role in the liberation of Ireland after 800 years of British occupation. But, you know, just give you a sense, I don't know much because he didn't say very much, but I know he spent a lot of time in prison.
It was hybrid. Strike.
Yeah. It was hybrid war. But he was one of 15,000 members of the IRA who received a decoration for being in combat during the Civil War. Hmm. And it just gives you a sense of the scale. The British Army decided not to be overly oppressive at a certain point in history against really a pretty small force.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we've reached the end of our show today. This has been great. Thank you for the discussion. Dr. Mike Hennessy, Professor Sean Costigan, thank you for joining us today on National Security This Week.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week, folks. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.